is Michael Brook from England, and I'm fascinated by the title of his topic, Joe Hill Was Not the Only Swedish-American Wobbly, because I really didn't know any Swedes who were wobblies when I grew up. My father told me they weren't, so I'm fascinated to hear all about this. Thanks.
This paper could only be written because of the foresight and wisdom of the late Valfrid Engdahl of Minneapolis, who preserved and presented to the Historical Society his file of alarm. Without that, there would have been one or two issues only, and nothing could be possible. Alarm was never intended to be a Minnesota paper. It was born in Seattle in January 1915 as Solidaritet, that means solidarity. Quote, a monthly official organ for the Scandinavian branch of the industrial workers of the world. Edward Mattson appears to have been its editor. 10 issues were published in Seattle, after which publication was transferred to Minneapolis. Mattson later giving these reasons, that a few comrades in Seattle had been forced to keep the paper afloat because, quote, you rendered your account so damn badly, and that the paper needed to be published in the center of the country, and in a city with many Scandinavian workers whose organizations were strong enough to stand behind it. Mattson felt that the first reason alone necessitated the move. He really regretted it very much. It is impossible to say for certain why Minneapolis was chosen over Chicago, but certainly there had been Scandinavian IWW activity in the city, no doubt intermittently, since 1906, the year after the new labor organization was founded. In addition, there had been abortive discussions in Minneapolis during the winter of 1910-11 about the starting of, quote, a Swedish-American brand or Folkvilja. Those were anarchist and socialist papers, respectively, in Sweden. An informant active in Minneapolis at that time thought that two IWW members, Carl Alteen and John Hellerstedt, were probably involved in these talks. It is also conceivable that the publishers of Alarm preferred not to be too close to the national headquarters of the IWW in Chicago. The first surviving issue of the new paper, renamed Alarm, and that's just what it does mean, for reasons unknown, indicates that it was, quote, published and controlled by the Scandinavian Propaganda League, Minneapolis, Minnesota. The propaganda leagues of the IWW, which were few in number, were ancillary to the organization proper and entirely propagandist in nature. Their members were not as such members of the IWW, so that they could be non-wage earners. Of the 8 leagues listed by Brissenden for 1914, all but one were in the West or Midwest, mostly in sizable communities. The only ethnic league at that time was Hungarian. At the 1916 IWW convention, it was decided to put to the membership a proposal by which no more propaganda leagues be set up, but offering them the possibility of becoming recruiting unions. The Scandinavian League did become a recruiting union, but the change did not appear in Alarm until August 15, 1917. Mattson stayed in Seattle, sending many contributions from there, and was succeeded as editor by Carl Alteen, whose early history is obscure. But he had contributed a report on the Colorado coal strike of 1913-14 to the Stockholm anarchist paper Brand. The St. Paul City Directory described him as a lineman in 1915, which may have had something to do with telephones, while Valfrid Engdahl recalled that Alteen had worked at Butler Brothers Warehouse in Minneapolis. Alteen is listed as editor through February 1916 only, the masthead thereafter saying that the paper was edited by a committee. The legally required statements of ownership, etc., however, state that Alteen alone was editor, and an announcement in January 1917 notes that the editor has been re-elected, so that we can regard him as editor until his arrest in September 1917. Alarm was a 6-column paper of 4 or 6 pages, coming out monthly through April 1917, and continuing as a semi-monthly until the end of publication in May 1918. Except for cartoons, 2 of them from the pen of Joe Hill, the paper was not illustrated, But from May 1916, it had a pictorial title signed by, quote, R.H. Chaplin, whom I take to be Ralph Hosea Chaplin, the editor of Solidarity and author of the autobiographical Wobbly, published in 1947, who was a trained artist, and as the husband of a Chicago Swede, Edith Medine, may have had a peculiar sympathy with his wife's people. A plaintive reply in Swedish, be it said, in the letter column, "The columns of alarm are open to Norwegian and Danish just as much as Swedish," followed by an appeal of articles, reflects the fact that probably 90% of the paper's content were in Swedish. But the editors did print a reasonably steady trickle of Norwegian and Danish contributions. Their authors, including two prominent members of the Socialist Party, Helle Mengsel, of whom we've heard this morning, and H.T. Thomson, editor of Socialdemokraten, which was the official Norwegian-Danish paper of the Scandinavian Socialist Federation and published in Chicago for the best part of a year in 1916-17. Thomson's contributions were poems in Danish, and he had also published poems in the Minneapolis socialist atheist magazine Forskaren, that means the investigator. Alarm never published any detailed or official circulation figures, but one can glean impressions from scattered statements. In 1916, the Seattle Scandinavian branch was distributing 200 copies a month. During the same year, total subscriptions increased threefold and street sales by 150%. In 1917, a comrade in Washington State sent in 64 subscriptions, and Alarm was said to have, quote, "a rather considerable readership in Seattle and district." If we bear in mind that there was also a good deal of IWW activity among Scandinavians in Minneapolis, Rockford, Illinois, and Chicago, and among loggers in Idaho and Washington, a circulation of upwards of 2,000 seems likely. At a time when Svenska Socialisten, the Swedish Socialist, the Chicago paper of the Socialist Party Swedes, had circulations of 7,000 in 1916 and 5,000 in 1917, and when Gorpor's 1917 sales were 4,500. The fact that Alarm's frequency was doubled in 1917 and that semi-monthly publication could be maintained to the end argues for a satisfactorily increasing circulation. The Sweden which the people around Alarm had left was the scene of intense syndicalist and anarchist activity in journalism and in the organization of dual labor unions. The syndicalist tended to be strongly opposed to organized religion, to militarism, and to national pride, and these sentiments appeared frequently in the paper, which on one occasion led to trouble with the Agricultural Workers' Organization, number 400 of the IWW, which for a time had its headquarters in Minneapolis. At its 1916 convention, the AWO went on record as being, quote, "opposed to circulation of Alarm as an IWW paper until such time as it is under control of the IWW. In its defense, Alarm published an editorial in July 1916, making clear that it was anti-religious and anti-state material that the AWO objected to, and reprinting a letter from W.T. Neff, secretary of number 400, to Haywood, secretary-treasurer of the IWW, complaining that anti-religious articles by Gud Hater, God Hater, and others were making it hard to recruit Swedes to the Union. Neff also took exception to an article by Valfrid Engdahl, Action and Thought, in the February 1916 issue, attacking the editor as what Neff wrote as anarchist, and must have meant anarchist, pure and simple. The breach seems to have been mended, for Alarm published reports from the AWO on work opportunities and its own organizing activity in a number of later issues. It may be significant that the IWW preamble, which is the basic foundation document of the IWW, was printed in every number beginning with August 1916. It is clear that Altin, whose editorials were always signed, prided himself on his hardness and realism. In an article on the Mesabi miners' strike of 1916, He reported with pleasure that the strikers had threatened to kill three company, quote, bloodhounds, if one striker was killed. While in an article in the January 17 number on A New International, he rejected idealism and insisted that the workers must fight for themselves. Power and power alone must be the sole motto of the working class, he wrote in an editorial, Meanings of Power in All Life's Manifestations. When Branch 62 of the Scandinavian Socialist Federation put forward a motion on shorter hours to the 1918 Minnesota State Convention of the Socialist Party, he scornfully asserted that strikes were the only way to win such improvements. This intransigence makes it the more interesting that when there seemed to be a good chance of an agreement between the AWO and the Nonpartisan League for the 1917 harvest season, by which workers would be hired through the IWW and paid a minimum wage of $5 a day, he welcomed the prospect, although the IWW generally was opposed to binding agreements between workers and employers. At the end of the harvest, Alteen returned to the subject of the League. Workers should try to come to an understanding of the mutual interests of the two organizations in a number of questions, including opposition to, quote, the rule of the trusts, and the possibility of farmers selling their products to workers without middlemen coming between them. Alarm reported and encouraged the organization of workers in maritime, including the Great Lakes, hotels and restaurants, logging, construction, metal mining, and domestic service. Swedish women are known to be numerous in this last field, so Alarm and the League were well placed to contribute to this work. Jane Street began to organize for the IWW in Denver in 1916 with considerable success. And in October of that year, Alarm published an article by Signe Aurel, a young Minneapolis laundress, urging maids to read and organize. Signe Aurel also contributed poems to Alarm and eventually a book of verses. In Duluth, the Hotel, Restaurant, and Domestic Workers Industrial Union advertised for an English and Swedish-speaking woman organizer in January 1917, while in April, the Domestic Workers Alone Industrial Union started to be active in Minneapolis, following an appeal by Ragnar Johansson, proposing that these workers set up a, quote, hiring hall and a home with a reading and an assembly room for dancers. By the end of April, two groups of domestic workers had been organized in Minneapolis, with meetings in their own languages and one joint meeting a month. A social evening using English, Finnish, and the Scandinavian languages was advertised, to be held at the new IWW Hall on Western, now Glenwood Avenue. Another vacancy for an organizer in Duluth was advertised in June, after which Alarm reported nothing more about the campaign in Minnesota. Some of these young women probably attended activities of the Scandinavian Propaganda League of Minneapolis, which was active at least from December 1915 to April 1918, holding weekly meetings during most of that time at the IWW halls at 232 Cedar and 11 and a half Western. For a time, alternate meetings were devoted to literary subjects. Strindberg's The Father was performed with Johansson and Engdahl in the cast. At a benefit for Alarm, there was music by the Scandinavian Recruiting Union Quartet. The Wobblies did not ignore the traditional religious calendar. In December 1915, one could attend a workers' julotta, that's a non-Eucharistic service held early on Christmas morning, at 7 a.m. on Christmas Day, with an address by Engdahl on Peace on Earth. While at 8 p.m. there was, quote, a splendid Christmas celebration, including a lecture by Johansson on, of all subjects, Strindberg and his life's work. On New Year's Eve, the program included Johansson speaking about Gustav Johnson, one of the victims of the Everett massacre, a review called When Alarm Came Into the World, and a dance. Although Alarm never printed articles on detailed aspects of the conduct of the war, which would have had to be translated and submitted to the postal authorities, it published after April 1917 articles by Alteen and Engdahl in fairly general terms but strongly anti-war in feeling, and in Alteen's case, recommending refusal to transport food for the military or bring up coal for war purposes. In September 1917, Altin Johansson and Siegfried Stenberg, business manager of the paper, were arrested, together with more than 150 other IWW leaders all over the country, and indicted on 5 counts, amounting in general to conspiracy to impede the conduct of the war. Edward Mattson was indicted, but managed to cross the border into Canada and return to Sweden. On October 15, Alarm announced that it was now edited by a nameless committee. Engdahl said 50 years later that it included himself and Carl Skoglund, who was later to achieve fame as leader of the Minneapolis Teamsters. The November 1st issue appealed to readers not to send articles on, quote, the war question as it affects the USA. By this time, second-class mailing privileges had been withdrawn on September 26, so that the annual subscription had to be raised from 75 cents to a dollar. Altin and Johansson continued to write from prison, but circumstances were becoming more difficult. In the winter of 1918, Alarm was confiscated in Seattle, and the addressee to whom it had been sent was arrested, and the last number came out on May 1, 1918. A successor, Faclan, The Torch, came out on September 1, 1918, but as far as is known, there were no more issues. Had Alarm survived, would it have contributed to the realignment of Minnesota politics? There is little evidence to guide us, quite apart from the fact that it had a good claim to be a national and not a Minnesota paper. Of the principal figures connected with it, Altin, Johansson, and Stenberg were deported to Sweden in 1923 after serving 5 years of the sentences they received at the mass trial in 1917. Altin's later life is shadowy. He seems to have given up labor journalism for a nature cure practice. Johansson and Stenberg spent the rest of their lives in the service of the Swedish and international syndicalist movement, both reaching positions of leadership. Mattson was active as a syndicalist for a further dozen years, but ended his career in the heart of the Swedish labor establishment as chairman of the Social Democratic Ironworkers Union. On the other hand, Skoglund, who combined IWW and Socialist Party membership, became a pioneer communist and Trotskyist, and so presumably did play a part in the farmer labor movement. While Engdahl, who described himself to me as a two-carder, became an official of the AFL Carpenters and a member of the Farmer Labor Party. A few non-Minnesota Swedes, such as Alan Blomqvist, L.H. Landén, and Oscar W. Larsson, and one Dane, Arne Swebeck, who were both Wobblies and Socialist Party members, moved into the Communist Party, but none of these appears to have been prominent among IW Scandinavians, i.e. they were in the IWW because it was a fighting union, not because they were syndicalists. We need to know a lot more about the Minnesota rank and file before we can make a judgment. Thank you.
Your name and where you're from.
I've been listening with a great deal of interest to the stories of these various newspapers, and I'd be very interested to know to what extent there was contact, collaboration, collegiality, sharing of mission and sharing of views and information among the papers during the course of their existence in Minnesota.
Would you like to start with that, Ava?
Would you repeat the question?
I believe the lady's question had to do with what or how much the extent of collegiality or sharing or exchange from one paper to the other. And perhaps we'll have someone else respond to that as well, because some of the other papers aren't represented on this particular panel. Do you get a sense that there was sharing between the different newspapers that we have been discussing today?
I think there are different ways of sharing different things. For example, it's very clear that those immigrant papers, the editors of immigrant papers were reading, of course, other papers. They were reading English language papers, and if they could, some other, like Swedish, a Finnish Swede could read a Swedish and Finnish paper perhaps. So they could take use of the articles and opinions in other papers, and that's how they were following, of course, what was happening in the country, and they were following the nationwide party papers or IWW papers, as now I am talking about. So in this sense, there is lots of sharing of ideas and communication going around in the country, not only in Minnesota. That was a much larger perspective I have found in the Finnish papers, at least. It was all the United States, in many cases Canada, and also the old continent.
Mm-hmm. Dick, do you have a comment?
When I read Truth, I was very interested in what they might have to say about either Tuamis or Industrialisti, and there was virtually nothing. The language barrier was made it impossible for any of the editors of Truth to read those newspapers. There are comments about political quarrels, of support of Lauki against some of his critics within the Finnish community. There are references to picnics, especially at Fairmount Park, which was a Finnish place to have a picnic. And the Finns would invite the Jewish local, the Scandinavian local, and the English local. There would be a speaker in each language, and they'd often close with the singing of the international in all the languages simultaneously. But the language barriers did really pose a problem. And I haven't found anything in Truth that even quotes from Industrialisti.
Okay, did you want to add something to that first album?
I would say that because I am kind of representing now this group behind the language barrier, that they had some editors who had quite good skills in English, perhaps. Perhaps some other languages too, like Swedish. In some cases.
Did they comment on Truth at any point in the paper?
Oh, that there were some news I have seen, yeah. Not only in Industrialisti, but also Socialist and Communist papers.
Okay, Michael, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, thank you. As far as Alarm was concerned, there was a little awareness, I'm sure, of the paper Forskare and this review, this magazine published in Minneapolis by atheist Swedish socialists. Valfrid Engdahl, in fact, worked on Forskare. But because of my apprehension about the time limits, I left out a lot of things I'd like to have said and put into the paper. And I didn't make clear enough that the people running Alarm were rather strict doctrinaire syndicalists, opposed to parliamentarism, thinking that political parties were really pretty useless. And so they really, I think, wouldn't have thought of most of the socialist papers as worth bothering with. They did reprint from papers in Scandinavia.
Thank you very much. It was an excellent question. Next question, please. I'm sorry, I don't... You need to be at the microphone. I believe you might have to delay your comment for a moment. Could we have the next question?
As a conference or a symposium on radicalism, I'd like to know that it sounds, at least to me, like what I've really heard is white male statists arguing about which white males should exercise power. And my question would be, what's so radical about this discussion?
Okay, could you give us your name and where you're from before you...
Oh, my name's Ken Sanderson, and I'm from Grand Rapids.
Thank you.
What was the question?
I think it was a reformulation of a previous question about that what we're discussing is a review of the white male supremacy and inherent in the newspapers of the ethnic groups affiliated with socialism, communism, radicalism, etc. And it's sort of, you know, you can expand on that if you'd like to.
I think that the so-called race problem or what you were talking about, that was not very central in this paper. I have been talking about the Finnish language Industrialisti. And there might be some reasons for that. For example, if we consider where these people were, who were readers of this paper, they used to be in the areas where the workers were usually almost totally of white race. And that's why I don't recollect any real writing about that kind of topic. But then later, when if we are talking about the communistic Finnish newspapers, it's very clear that they talk about equality between races all the time in the Finnish language papers also.
And I believe his question incorporated between the sexes.
Yeah, the same question. That it's very well known that according to my opinion, in Finnish communities, both in Finland and in the United States, the question of equality between the sexes is perhaps in quite good order. And it, in my opinion, it has been for a long time. For example, in Finland, the voting rights were the first to be given to women in the world, as I understand, in 1906. And that's why the women have been always very active in Finnish labor movement in Finland and in the United States. But there is only one problem, that in the IWW supporters, I haven't found very active women. But on the contrary, I have seen that Finnish immigrant women were very active in the socialist and later in the communist and cooperative movements. So, and they were one, among the leaders.
Thank you. We might get Marianne Wargeland Brown to comment on that question at some point, since we just had a three-year conference on reunion of sisters and women of Finland and women in America of Finnish descent, and yeah, all the languages there, but it's not a whole lot different in the reflection in public office, etc., of women versus male. I'm sorry to answer that question as well. I know it wasn't posed to me. Michael, would you like to?
Yes, thank you. Alarm published a number of articles by women of varying degrees of feminism, and it wasn't a major subject they were interested in. I must admit the IWW was interested in as a whole. I only remember seeing one reference to blacks, and that was from Ragnar Johansson, who was a recent immigrant from Sweden. The questioner said, what's so radical about it all? Well, I think the only answer you can say is that that's what radicalism was at the time, and that's, you know, what we're trying to get out of today's discussion.
Thank you. Dick, did you want to add something to that?
Well, I tried to address this in my talk, and I think that truth was much stronger on feminist issues than it was on race issues, but that compared to the non-socialist press at the time, truth was way ahead.
Mm-hmm. Next question, please.
I should like to inquire of the Frank Meyer again. I should like to inquire of the panel whether and to what extent the Minnesota socialist and communist press of yesterday handled the issue as to how money income should be distributed in the United States as between women and men. While women are not identical with men, the American human equality proposition affirms that women and men are created equal and independent, and that from that equal creation they derive rights inherent and unalienable. What about applying this postulate of American democracy to the idea of equal income for women and men?
Do you want to address that, Dick?
Truth under... three of the four editors explicitly endorsed equal pay for equal work.
Okay. Michael?
I don't recall seeing equality of income being discussed very much in Alarm. There were emphasis on the importance of women staying in industry, but on the other hand, some contributors took a quite patriarchal view. Man was the natural head of the household breadwinner and all the rest of it, and that it's a bad thing for women to be in industry.
Okay, Susanna, did you want to comment on that? And would you come up here so it would be on the recording, please?
Just one item. I know in the Two Harbor Socialist, every issue would have a directory of the State Socialist Party and the National Socialist Party, and there was always a woman state organizer. And I know in 1916, her salary, I think, per month was $100, which back then was probably an okay salary.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Additional questions, please, before we have a few-minute coffee break. Someone who hasn't asked one. I know, I can't believe that this is the same morning organization. Another question.
I don't have a question. I just had a comment on an earlier question. Somebody asked about connections between the different papers. And I haven't read the New Times or Alarm, but I've read the Secret Service intelligence reports. And they were following both Alexis Georgian and Carl Alten day and night. And Carl Alten was frequently in Alexis Georgian's bookstore. And a number of things that when he wanted something printed, Alexis Georgian was also ran a printing press. And so Alten would take things to him to have them printed. And according to the Secret Service people, they were the best of friends. I don't know, you know, how much you can take that as being the truth or not. But there obviously was some connection between the two men.
Thank you very much for your information. Did you give where you're from?
Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis, thank you.
Hi, I'm George Desard from Duluth. I'm going to ask a rhetorical question. That's the kind you answer yourself. And then I'm going to make a couple of quick statements. The rhetorical question is, I'm not sure whether this is a celebration or a requiem. I hope it's a celebration of some of the winning causes that we're going to have on the horizon.
Are you speaking of today?
Yeah, I'm talking about today.
Oh, I thought it was a historical conference, but go ahead.
That's exactly the point that I'm going to make, Arlene. The radicals of the past were not always right, but some of the radicals of the past and some of the present are always radical, and there's a distinction there. And to those of you who consider yourself in the left, breaks at its weakest link. But wait a minute, I got one other thing I want to make first. I'll omit that other one. But as I say, a chain breaks at its weakest link. Now, if you go back to the period of World War I, the Soviet Union, which was then called Tsarist Russia, was defeated in the War of 1905, stumbled into the World War I, and was the Tsarist Empire was not able to carry its role in the war as one of the Allied powers. And the system collapsed, literally, and the Bolsheviks took advantage of that. Now, at that time, and here again, this ties up with what I said about a chain breaking in its weakest link. In many respects, the Soviet Union, Tsarist Russia, and China were the two weakest links in the capitalism and imperialism. Russia, for the simple reason, because 97%, I think the figure is, of their people were illiterate in 1917. And basically peasants and so on, not to mention superstitions and all the rest of it. And it's a miracle they did as well as they did with as few mistakes as they made, and they made plenty of them. The same thing with China. Here we have a country with a billion population, much of the land not being arable, heavily mountainous and so on. So there too it's a miracle that they were able to do as well as they have done under the circumstances. Now obviously with Glasnost in the Soviet Union, Perestroika and the whole bit, and what's going on in China, we are on the threshold, apparently, of a new situation in the world vis-a-vis this question of capitalism versus socialism and or whatever. And it would seem to me that the responsibility that we bear in this country is to try and prevent the Bush administration and his past CIA connections from getting us embroiled into what could lead to a further military conflicts and so on. I think we're on the threshold of a period which can be a boon to humankind, and I use the word humankind in the generic sense, or else we're going to go back to a dark age period because we cannot forever remain in limbo, it would seem to me. And that's the point that I want to make, that it's excellent that we're having this conference, but the important thing is, where in the hell are we going to go from here, and what are we going to do?
You've nailed the topic of our discussion as soon as the coffee break is over, but before that, could we have any particular comments on that statement from any of the panelists? Okay. Okay. I think you said it all, George. Thank you very much. I have to do a little one moment response before we break here for coffee, and that's, first of all, I had great fears about and upset about coming here, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to accept the responsibility for being here today and for being associated and being a moderator of this conference, because I spent my six, actually more than that in politics, but 6 years in the legislature, trying to distance myself from my father's radical past and from what labels that attached to me, because I knew full and well that I would never be elected in the first place, much less ever re-elected, if I didn't do so. And that's rather sad, and I feel quite safe today because I don't, you know, I'm fairly sure that I'm not going to be running for any other political offices to make that kind of a statement and associate myself with even the topic of radicalism. And there's a real reality, emotional reality, that you have to deal with there. And I personally want to thank the Historical Society and all of the other supporters and Carl Ross and the people that are associated with this conference today for sort of making it possible for me to accept and acknowledge my own radical past and my own feelings. Thank you. And in that vein, I'd also like to thank the Planning Committee, who do have coffee out there for us, Catherine Petrosky from the Radicalism Project, Betty Rausch Gilman from the Radicalism Project and the Minnesota Historical Society, and Hi Berman from the University of Minnesota and Old Lovell, Bob Zack and Mary Pruitt for all being members of the Planning Committee for this conference. And we'll come back for some more heated discussion with all of the panelists in about 15 minutes. Ready to do our most focused, hopefully, question and answer and discussion for the afternoon, and you have all panelists to respond to any one question. Not that they all have to if they don't want to, but if they want to, they certainly may. And so this open period of discussion as well, we really, I know there are people who don't like to go to the microphone, but it's, you know, the spotlight isn't even on the thing. So all you have to do is give your name and where you're from and pop the question and let us try to establish this rapport and this educational process whereby we can all move forward. First question.
Yes, my name's Bob Schultz, Minneapolis. My question is related to, I'm a historian, and it's related to historical methods and assumptions, although I have my own political beliefs, so I won't go into those. I see in three of the presentations anyways, the Haynes presentation, Frenkel, and Huddleston, what I see is a continuing debate between that came out of the study of communism. I see a continuation of the Draper thesis, and which pretty much spends time denouncing the ideological rigidity of the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and then people who are trying to study socialism or communism in specific localities and under specific conditions, and people who are working and struggling to make meaning out of their lives in particular situations. I see Haynes pretty much with the Draper thesis, and Frenkel and Huddleston the antithesis to that. And my question is to Mr. Haynes, the New Times, you said that the New Times didn't understand the mind of the Minnesota worker. Implicitly then, it seems to me that you do. But all your sources are the New Times. And so I don't understand what the basis of that is, but I think from your talk that you're basing your assertion that they didn't understand the mind of the Minnesota worker on the fact that Minnesota voted for mainstream reformist candidates. And I was wondering if you had quantitative data on those election results, or if you're just assuming that because Minnesota as a whole voted for a reformist candidate, that these workers voted for a reformist candidate. In Professor Berman's very interesting introduction to this whole thing, he noted that many of these people were recent immigrants from Western Europe and Southern Europe, and due to the language barrier, I wonder if many of these people were citizens, if they could vote, and if they wanted to vote. So, a response to that question, please.
Well, I think the question of asking what the SP success was in terms of votes is asking the question the SP asked itself, because the Socialist Party in this period said repeatedly that the working class was able to take power politically, that the working class was the overwhelming majority of the Minnesota population, and that all they needed to do was vote right and they would win. Now, as a matter of fact, with the proper candidate and with a proper approach, they did win some elections, such as Van Leer's election. But the point is, Van Leer could win running a essentially reformist progressive campaign in Minneapolis. At the same time, the SP could not win in Minneapolis running a more socialist-oriented campaign. That's why Van Leer essentially carried no one into office with him on the SP slate when he ran in 1916. I don't think the Socialist Party's failure in the 19-teens was due to the fact that there were too many of its constituency who were not yet citizens. By its own criteria, it was a political failure. And I don't think there's any need to go too far beyond that. If we're going to use a criteria where it doesn't count, where votes don't count in this period, essentially there's no point of even regarding the SP as politically relevant to a discussion in this period. Keep in mind, we're not talking about the SP getting, you know, look at the number of votes. 1912 is their high point, 8%. 8% of the vote. The prohibitionists do better in Minnesota than the SP. And the question you ought to ask yourself is, why is that? Now, there are a lot of ways to answer that. And certainly the way I suggested today is not offered as a complete answer. But what I'm suggesting is that if you read New Times for this period, it suggests that one of the reasons why the socialists did not do better than they actually did in Minnesota lies within their own view of what the world consisted of. Now, I don't think there is any assumption on my part that I am in a position to read the minds of Minnesota workers in that period. There's only an assertion on my part that on reading New Times, I can tell that they didn't understand the workers' minds. Now, remember, this is their own criteria. They claimed they did. They claimed that they knew through scientific socialism what the workers' mind was. That was their own assertion. And my argument here is on reading New Times that you're likely to reach the conclusion that, in fact, they did not know the mind of Minnesota workers in that period.
Would anyone else like to respond to that?
Let me get in here just for a quick comment. If we're going to equate the Socialist Party of America at the time of its height, 1912 to 1917, and I'm using 1912 to 17 rather than say 12 as being the height, because despite the fact that there was fragmentation, there was still continued effectiveness and some success. But if we're going to equate that period of the Socialist Party of America with the Social Democratic Parties of Western Europe at that same time, then I think we're making a wrong comparison. We're making a wrong comparison for many different reasons. One, the state of development of the American working class in the United States as compared to that of Western Europe, the nature of American politics and the political party system compared to that of Western Europe. And to look at the Socialist Party strictly in terms of its electoral successes or failures is, I think, a mistake. I see the Socialist Party of America in that period as really being a successful protest movement. A successful protest movement does not, in fact, get to elect the President of the United States, does not, in fact, get to elect significant numbers of congresspeople. But it was an effective social protest movement in that it was an instrument for the mobilization and galvanizing of certain reform impulses and certain organizational impulses for the unorganized American workers. They were able to do it in Oklahoma with the farmers, in the Dakotas with the farmers through the Nonpartisan League. True, those who did it left the Socialist Party to do that, but they're still basically socialists. They were able to do it in Milwaukee with the municipal reform movement. They were able to do it through the AFL in terms of organizing workers in the brewery industry, machinists, garment trades, and so on and so forth. They were able to do it, peculiarly through the IWW in some way. So I see that as a successful protest movement in its own terms. Now, the Socialist Party did not. I agree with John. The Socialist Party saw themselves in American electoral terms. That is to say, if in fact the working class is the majority in American society, and if we get the majority to vote for us, we'll win. Well, that's too mechanical and simplistic and non-realistic, given the nature of the American political system. So I would discard that as a criterion for judging success, although they themselves, the socialists, did. To me, I think the major failing of the Socialist Party, or at least of the radical movement in this period, is a failing that was not intrinsic in the movement itself, but grew out of the conditions, the world situation, the ideological conflicts that in fact embraced that movement. And essentially, let me put it in very blunt terms, essentially it was the adoption of the radical socialist movement of a dictatorial kind of hierarchical system of control, of organization, and of ideology that forgot that the basic essential ingredient in any kind of improvement of the lot of any human being, working class, if you want to call it working class, was in fact the condition of allowing the working class, the workers themselves, and those in the society itself, full maximum ability to develop their own creativity, their own right of self-expression, and in other words, the failure to incorporate democratic principles and practices in a radical movement or socialist movement was the fundamental failure of American radicalism in the late teens and the early 20s.
Thank you. You have something to add, Mike? Dick, I mean.
It seems like, I don't know if I'm picking up on things right, but there's a tendency to blame the communists for the demise of the American socialist movement. And the criticisms come from conflicting points of view. The criticisms come from conflicting points of view. On the one hand, there is the criticism of the socialists as being insensitive to women's issues and immigrant culture. And yet, it's the communist faction which seems more sensitive to those issues than the right-wing faction. As to the, I've forgotten what the other direction of criticism was. The democracy issue is one, this is a separate point. I'm certainly in favor of a democratic movement. I don't think that the loss of democracy was the cause of the downfall of the movement, because it seems to me that things fell apart before there was a significant loss of democracy. Things fell apart across the board. It was not only the socialists that had trouble, the IWW, the AFL. The progressive movement sort of flourished briefly, but I don't think really sustained itself throughout the 1920s. And those were democratic in structure. I think the problems are more complicated, and I would want to resist trying to blame the communists, I guess, for what happened.
Okay. Anyone else would like to respond to that? Next question, please.
I'm Rudy Pinola.
From?
And I come from Hudson, Wisconsin.
Thank you.
I would like to ask the panel a simple question as to whether they felt that the various publications that they reviewed, socialist and radical publications that they reviewed and studied, had failed to articulate the true, putting the word true in quotation marks, the true philosophy behind the ideology that they were trying to promote. And if you believe that they did fail, why did they fail? My second observation and question is, do you feel that these publications may have suffered a bit from schizophrenia? In the sense that on the one hand, they were trying to be, to some degree, true blue to the cause, while at the same time wanting to accommodate the socialization, and I'm not talking, when I talk socialization, I'm not talking socialist, I'm talking social intercourse that people wanted to have in their neighborhoods and ethnic groups.
Susanna, would you like to start the response on that?
I guess one thing that impressed me, and it's always hard, I think, from our perspective to look back to this time period, realizing that, for example, in Two Harbors, most of these Swedish, Norwegian, English, Irish, a whole mixture of immigrants found themselves in this community where they wanted to earn a livelihood. And within 10 or 15 years, they created these socialist entities. They elected people to public office. They brought about change in their communities. And I think of myself, having I've lived in Duluth 19 years, and I certainly wouldn't think that I and a group of a couple hundred people could have made major changes in the last 15 years. And yet to think that not only did they do that, but they also formed this tremendous community, which I think has been lost to us in modern life. And I've been trying to get a handle on that. I guess I need to study a lot more about this, you know, one small town to really get a handle on that, and really understanding not only, you know, this heterogeneous immigrant community and what they are able to bring together, and, you know, whether that their socialism was a part of that. Maybe people can comment on that more, I think.
Perhaps Alvo could, let's take the newspaper presenters specifically in order, and then we'll come back to Hai. Alvo?
I understand that the question was about the kind of preservation of the ideology of the paper, and in this respect the Finnish language industrialisti was following quite well the major movement, or IWW and its other publications, and that's it's also said that this newspaper industrialisti was kind of stuck in those ideologies or in those statements they made in 1910s or early 1920s, and that happened even in 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. So they kind of stayed in that kind of situation, and they couldn't really develop after that. And that's my answer to this question. So they at least tried to follow the official line of IWW, and they kind of freeze there, and they
failed to grow.
Yeah.
Dick?
I was tremendously impressed with Truth, both for its philosophical depth and for its sensitivity to what was happening. And it was constantly trying to struggle to revise its thought in light of what was happening. It seems to me to be a case of where people thought as well as you could have expected, and did a great job.
Well, I don't know how complete an answer we should give. I think the thing that struck me with Gopa was the fact that it reflected the views of people who had gained insight into social democratic principles in Norway before immigrating to the United States, and that they, to a large extent, were able to adjust these and use these with, in a pragmatic fashion in the political climate of Minnesota. The, for instance, Menzel's opposition to strikes, because he found them cruel, ineffective means, maybe is one example of his pragmatism, and also a sense of his rejection of the American Federation of Labor, which would be behind many of these strikes. And he kept his contact with the social democratic groups in Norway throughout the newspaper's life. And one thing which is interesting is that the newspaper was a family venture. It was privately owned, which was something of a oddity within the principles of the Socialist Party itself, because any newspaper should maybe be tied to some institution. And this became a major issue once the Social Demokraten, the official organ of the Socialist Party in the Scandinavian Federation, Chicago, when that began coming out in 1911. After a while, Menzel simply ignored it. They began by having a tremendous fight over this issue, whether or not Menzel should give his subscription list to the people in Chicago and then fold. He refused to do that, and after that, he simply ignored his sister publication in Chicago in a very independent way. And I think the after the paper was it lost its mailing privileges and it came back, it certainly changed character a lot. And it was able to build its circulation again, I think, by being able for a while to capitalize on this very great farm labor movement. But then, because the farm labor movement itself had more interesting publications in the English language, it was no longer able to compete, and then simply passed out of existence in 1925. It is somewhat disappointing to see the change in Folke's arrest from Goebel, because Menzel, at that point, thinks more of as simply feeding his family than expressing ideology. In Goebel, he's very courageous very often, and actually sometimes you can understand why he lost his mailing privileges, given the temper of the time and the laws that existed. After a paper comes out again, becomes opportunistic in a sense, and sort of bends with the wind. And so I think that is a tremendous change there.
Thank you. Michael?
I think that Alarm was perhaps almost too successful in fighting for the doctrines of syndicalism, which were one way of interpreting the IWW's view of society. Was it really maintained those? I would say that it was more successful where it did bend to the wind of reality and take an interest in agreements between the Agricultural Workers Organization and the Nonpartisan League and so on. I feel that this accommodation was the most successful part of Alarm's existence.
Thank you. John?
I think New Times took quite seriously throughout its existence its responsibility to articulate what it judged to be orthodox Marxist socialism. The version it articulated was rather mainstream socialism for the American SP, and quite in line with that of most of the major parties of Europe. So I don't think it faced in applying those doctrines to Minnesota issues some dilemmas in some times, but it never attempted to find theoretical revision that would deal with that. It simply decided those were issues that didn't have to be dealt with. In, for example, Van Leer's campaign in 1916, it simply said, "We're socialists. We articulate all of these orthodox socialist programs, and we also have this this reform campaign too. You get both of them when you vote for Van Leer." Of course, when Van Leer was actually elected, it was then left with the problem of deciding which had people actually voted for, and it had its own doubts. about whether voters had voted for socialist orthodoxy or for the Reform Party. So I don't think there was any failure on New Times' part about following what it regarded as orthodoxy in the over the entire period.
Okay, Ha, you want a concluding remark?
Well, very simply, I think that the question about conforming to ideological principles of all of the newspapers that we've been looking at today, there is no doubt that in their own lights, in the lights of the editors, and the rights of the organizers of these newspapers, they were in fact taking theory very seriously and trying to apply it to the practical concerns that they were writing about. Without deviating, it seems to me, from what they thought to be important. The Industrialisti obviously thought that what was important was industrial union organization to eventually get industrial union government and working class liberation, and the others in the same way. And they remain fairly consistent. But I think, you know, I don't think that people here should go away with the idea that these were the only newspapers, socialist or radical newspapers, or voices of dissent, that the people, interested people in Minnesota were reading. There were others that they were reading. Appeal to Reason had a large circulation in Minnesota, very large circulation in Minnesota. It was, of course, socialist, or claimed to be socialist, but it was much more populist than it was socialist. It was much more geared to agrarian egalitarianism than it was socialist. And it remained principled to that. Another newspaper that was very, very widely read in Minnesota during the period from 1910 to 1920 was the Jewish Daily Forward. It was the only socialist Yiddish newspaper in the whole United States, and there wasn't one in Minnesota. And there was a large Jewish socialist movement in Minnesota, in Two Harbors and in the north side of Minneapolis and west side of St. Paul, in Duluth, I mean, all over. And the Forbits went all over. Now, the Forbits, well, if you want to comment on that, it remained, or at least it had among its writers and editors, individuals who were, in fact, very, very consistently and persistently ideologically socialist, but it also had an editor who was committed, Abraham Kahn, who was committed to the assimilation and the integration of Jewish immigrants into American life. To that extent, and to that degree, he was, in fact, not supportive of the same kinds of activities that the Tschumis supported, or the Industrialisti supported, or some of the other things supported. So, consequently, the difference is there. And perhaps the rates of assimilation may be found in the differential approach towards cultural and ethnic and linguistic integration, rather than the ideological side. On the ideological side, where it comes to socialism, there was consistency, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. And I think I just passed a note because I wasn't sure about the two of them, and then you covered it as I was writing it. Marianne, were you next, or were the young lady next to you, I believe? Your name, please.
My name is Maggie Moffitt. I'm from Minneapolis. And
a little louder, please.
Okay. A few people have alluded to the Minnesota Commission on Public Safety in their talks, and I just wondered, there was kind of a negative tone, and I just wondered, who were they, and how do they affect the radical movement?
That's a $50 million question.
Well, Professor Carl Krislock has just finished a manuscript on the history of the Minnesota Public Safety Commission, and he's in the audience, so I think he's in the audience, is he? Or has he already left? Well, I guess he's left. Anyway, he's there.
He is here.
He's there. Perhaps we should get him up here to give a lecture on that.
Well, I'm not sure we want an entire lecture.